Here in 1 Chronicles 14, you've got a lot of ups and downs in the life of David. When I was a really young guy, I used to go to Hardy Whitaker, and he would do little Bible study sessions with a small group of us. And he would give us a series of questions on the life of a Bible character, and David was one that came up quite often. And we would look at the different incidents and try to score David out of 10. Or whoever it was we were studying. And then we had a graph, because Harry was a maths teacher. And the idea was that time was along the bottom, of course, and up the vertical axis was mark out of 10. What do you rate David at this particular point or over this incident? And of course, there'd be much debate about how to score him. And the idea was that you gave them the score, and then you joined up the dots, and you got this terribly jagged graph. Like, it's pretty high, of course, when he kills Goliath, pretty low when he sleeps with Bathsheba and kills Uriah. Well, that's an exercise that's not beyond criticism, of course. Who are we to judge, and how on earth do you really factor in all different factors that there were? But it's a good exercise to just exercise the mind a little bit. And if you were to apply that approach to 1 Chronicles 14, you would have a pretty jagged graph over a very short time period. Let's start with verse 3. David's established in his kingdom, so he takes more wives at Jerusalem. As soon as he becomes established king, he takes more wives. Deuteronomy 17:17, the king of Israel was not to multiply wives. And when you look at the genealogies in 1 Chronicles, he had really quite a number of kids. He had quite a number of women in his life. And in fact, that's one reason he's so condemned for what he did with Bathsheba. And so I don't see that this would score him particularly high. I think you'd say, no, this is weakness. Then verse 4, these are the names of the children whom he had in Jerusalem. Now this is obviously going ahead a bit in time. Shammua, Shobab, Nathan, Solomon. These were the sons of Bathsheba. And you note that him and Bathsheba had a child whom they called Nathan. Now Nathan was the prophet who came and, as it were, condemned David and Bathsheba, or David particularly, for what he had done. And he names one of the children he has by Bathsheba Nathan. And oddly enough, in Luke 3:31, on the genealogy there, it was sort of through Nathan that the Lord Jesus was descended back to David, not actually through Solomon. So, what you see there, I think, is pretty good. A humility, a recognition that I really appreciate the person who pointed out my error. And, yeah, I think you'd rate him pretty highly. But then verse 7, Elishama, Baaliada, and Eliphelet. Well, Baaliada. Well, I'm afraid that is literally Baal Yada. I'm afraid it's got the name of Baal in it. And you wonder about David's wives. Well, you know that Michal is his wife, Saul's daughter. She was an idolater. She had idols in the house. And when her dad sends men to arrest David, she goes and sticks one of them, a life-sized one, in his bed. And she says, nah, David's sick. Well, actually, it was one of her idols that she'd put in the bed. So, I think that idolatry was a perennial problem throughout Israel's history. And in fact, if you look at the names of some of Jonathan's kids of Saul, they've got this Baal prefix or suffix in them. And it shouldn't have been. You know, the names of these idols should not have been there. And here you have Elishama, yeah, it's got L in. Eliphelet, it's got L in. But then Baal Yada, it's got Baal in. Well, I would mark him pretty low for that. Verse 10. David inquired of God, saying, shall I go up against the Philistines? Will you deliver them into my hand? God said, go up, I will. Well, this recalls how he asked Yahweh when Saul died, whether he should go into Judah, into which city there. I think a man of lesser humility and closeness to God would have just assumed things. And yet he doesn't assume or presume in this instance. He asks God. And this desire for continual guidance, which you see in the Psalms 119 particularly, it is commendable. And I think you'd mark him pretty strong there. And then, well, he wins the victory. Verse 12, they left their gods there, and David gave commandment, and they were burned with fire. Well, you would say, oh, that's pretty good. But actually, when you compared it with the parallel in 2 Samuel 5:21, it says they left their images there, and David and his men took them away. Well, that wasn't so smart, was it? He took away the idols, took them with him, didn't destroy them straight away, but in the end, David gave commandment and they burnt them, putting the two records together. So there you have weakness and strength all mixed together. Verse 15, again, there's another conflict, and God says, when you hear the sound of marching in the tops of the mulberry trees, that then you shall go out to battle. In verse 16, David did as God commanded him. Well, that sound was the marching of the angels, like the noise of the angel cherubim, maybe, in Ezekiel 1. They are called, the angels are called God's hosts or God's armies. And the idea was that David's army on earth was just a reflection of the Yahweh of hosts, of soldiers, that was above him. So the idea was that he didn't win the victory in his own strength, but by doing what Paul calls keeping and walking in step with the Spirit. Once the angels had moved forward, David was to move forward, but not until. David alludes to this, I think, as a regular experience when he says that Yahweh goes out with the hosts of Israel in Psalm 60, verse 10. And this is the idea here, that his hosts therefore became as the hosts of God. It says that in 1 Chronicles 11:22. He was walking in step with the angel cherubim that were above him. So that's pretty good. Mark him pretty good for that. Well, just in this chapter, let alone in David's life, the graph gets pretty jagged. It's going up and down all over the place. And you look at your own life, look at your life over the last 24 hours. It's pretty jagged. Is it not? You got impatient with that guy who was driving like a complete maniac, or that person who was a complete idiot in the way they were driving, or whatever. And then you remember to pray to God about Johnny's son, who's apparently pretty sick, and then you were extremely patient when you were provoked by a domestic situation. And then you got extremely angry and cranky when the cooking that you were doing got burnt. And then you did sit down and read the Bible or whatever it might be. And this is how life goes. And we are not saved by sort of keeping on the up all the time. The point is that we shall die imperfect. This is quite clear from so many biblical examples, and I think of David himself, who I think said some pretty cranky things when he died, like bring the white head of Shimei down to the grave with blood, when he had earlier forgiven Shimei. He didn't keep that intensity to the end. We're not saved by keeping ourselves always on a spiritual plateau. This up and down business, people find very depressing sometimes, but it is part of, unfortunately, our existence, whether it should be so. And we are not to just shrug and say that morality and failure don't matter. Not at all. But the jagged graph is, like it or not, the experience of God's people now. And I think one of the things I long for is the permanence of spirituality in God's kingdom.